In elementary school, one of my favorite classes was music class, but it wasn't for the traditional reasons. Although I enjoyed playing the instruments and I enjoyed singing, what I enjoyed most was talking with my friends and goofing around in class. And in a noisy music class where our teacher was very often busy with someone else, there was ample opportunity. I remember one class in particular. We were all playing the xylophone. Dave, you remember the xylophone from elementary school? Yeah. Have you played the xylophone before? Lots of you didn't. Wow. Okay, so a xylophone is a barred instrument that you play with a mallet, okay? So in your imaginations, imagine barred instrument, crazy kids holding mallets. So we had been asked to do some exercises on these xylophones. And my friend was sitting in front of me, had finished early. And so he was sitting one step down from me, and he turned, and we were talking together and goofing around. And at one point during our conversation, he took one of his mallets, turned towards me, and playfully threw it back at me. In the wisdom of my 10-year-old brain, with my underdeveloped prefrontal cortex, unable to make good decisions for myself or others, I took my own mallet and threw it back a little bit harder. But he was ready. He dodged my throw, and this is where things in my memory become very clear. As my spinning, twirling mallet flew beside my friend's head, flew between two other students, and it looked like it would fly safely to the other side of the class. Unfortunately, this was not what happened. My flying, spinning mallet just so happened to be flying through the air when my teacher, who was bent over in the first row helping another student, as they were supposed to be doing their exercises on the xylophone, stood up and looked towards the classroom. And she got hit with my mallet. Now, fortunately, I was holding my breath to see what would happen. So because I was holding my breath in anticipation, hoping that my mallet would fly safely across the room, I was held stiff, and I hadn't pulled my arm back. So I was still in a throwing motion. And she looked up, having been hit by this mallet, and some of you are teachers here and thinking, what a wild child. I can't believe that students do this stuff. But she had caught me. So she looked up, called me by name, came up to the top of the stairs where I was, grabbed my arm, took me to one of the two rooms in the back of the classroom. And these were noise-proof rooms designed so that someone who was playing an instrument could go into one of these rooms and practice quietly without disturbing the rest of the class. Clearly, there were also soundproof rooms designed to keep meddling, troublesome kids quiet during a class as well. And so she took me into this class, took me into the corner, and said, "Don't move and don't make a noise." Being 10 years old and felt like I'd already pushed my luck, I listened. Then she closed the door and locked it from the outside. I sat in the corner for probably what was 20 minutes, but felt much longer, until the lights went out. I stood up and looked out the thick glass window that was designed to keep my voice out, and the room was empty. Yeah, my time was up, that's right. The room was empty, and the lights were out. And it being a Friday afternoon, I was worried that I would get left over the weekend, and I was scared. In this dark room, and what felt like a hopeless situation. That as I went over to reach for the door, I tried to open it up, but it was locked from the outside, and I realized that I had no ability to escape from this dark and desperate situation. And so I yelled and I screamed for help and waved my arms to no avail. This went on for probably an hour as I waited outside this window, hoping someone would come back, until my teacher came back into the room, turned on the lights, and walked around casually until at the corner of her eye, she saw me waving my hands for her. She came over opened the door. We looked at each other, didn't say a word, and we never spoke about it again. In retrospect, this story's funny. It wasn't at the time, but it is now. As troublesome kid gets what he deserves, locked in a room, and nothing bad happened in the end. And yet I have talked with people who in their own stories, they feel trapped. And that their story is not funny. That they feel like their future, that their story, that the new hope, that the door to that new hope is locked from the outside, and they have no ability to change their present circumstances and no hope of seeing a new future. A man who is buried under a mountain of unpayable credit card debt. A couple whose relationship is so filled with conflict and strife that they can no longer remember the good memories of the past and feel no hope for resolution in the future. Or a young UBC student who feels such expectation that has been placed on her by her parents for her to succeed, and she feels that she cannot live up to these expectations, that she is filled with shame and depression. Where do you feel trapped? Where do you feel like the door to your life or your future or a new hope is locked from the outside? Either in your own life, in a relationship, or in your past. Well, today we're going to look at the life of Ruth, a woman whose past was filled with shame and who's in a present dark and desperate circumstance. And what we'll see is that in the eyes of God, there are no hopeless situations or unredeemable people. If you have your Bibles, I invite you to turn to Ruth 3, or if you have them on a phone or an iPad, to pull those out. If you've been away the last 2 weeks, let me catch us up on where we are. Naomi and her husband and her two children leave the city of Bethlehem to go to Moab, which is a few days' journey east of Bethlehem because of a famine. When they arrive in Moab, they settle down and their two children marry Moabite women. And then in Moab, disaster strikes as their two children and Naomi's husband die. And Naomi, in her grief and her mourning, turned to go back to Bethlehem and tell her children to stay. And one of her children does stay, stays in Moab with her parents, or one of her daughters-in-law stays in Moab. And the other daughter-in-law named Ruth, we're told, clings to her mother-in-law, Naomi, and says, "Your God will be my God, that I will leave my family, my past, my culture all behind to follow and to cling to you." And then when they get to Bethlehem, we're told that they are in a dark and desperate financial and personal situation. As widows and as women with no social connections, feeling very little ability, and they would have had very little ability to change their outward circumstance, they were in a dark and desperate personal and economic situation. And so Ruth goes to work in a field, and we're told that it chance just so happened to be the field of a man named Boaz, who was a distant relative of Naomi. And working in the field, Boaz, even though Ruth is an outsider, even though that in the eyes of so many others that she would have been a write-off, not belonging to this people, not belonging to their family, having no social connections, that Boaz showed her kindness and tenderness and favor and protected her and gave her provision, even when it came to a cost to his own bottom line. In Naomi's eyes, knowing the culture of Bethlehem, she thought maybe even Boaz had a little extra care for Ruth, a little extra affection for her. That's right. Had baby eyes for her. That's right. And then we get to chapter 3 where we read this. This is God's word. "One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, 'My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. Now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, get dressed in your best clothes, then go down to the threshing floor. But don't let him know that you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. Would you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you that you do not believe in hopeless situations or unredeemable people. That you were born in a lowly manger in Bethlehem to make a promise to us. That you are with us in our darkness, that you are for us. That we are not hopeless or unredeemable. To each of us here who feel like we are trapped, seeing it difficult to get out of the situation or past, I pray that you would speak to them powerfully today. They would know the great hope and redemption that you have for them. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. We're in a sermon series here at 10th called Journey to Bethlehem. And we're journeying with Naomi and Ruth back to Bethlehem and looking at the story of Ruth. They say if you want to know someone, then you need to look at their family tree. And Ruth is the great, 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 many more greats, grandmother of Jesus. And so by looking at the story of Ruth, at Jesus' family tree, we're going to be looking in order to point forward back to another journey to Bethlehem that takes place, which culminates in the birth of Jesus in a stable and in a manger in Bethlehem. And that the redemption that takes place in Ruth's story will point forward to the redemption that takes place in Jesus' own life. And so we're going to look at chapter 3 and the three main movements of chapter 3, which are Naomi's plan, Ruth's proposal, and Boaz's promise. We're going to see that in God's eyes, there are no hopeless situations or unredeemable people. And before I jump into chapter 3, I want to acknowledge that as we unpack this, that for many of you, that this is going to be a strange and troubling text. Perhaps you've read Ruth 3 before, you remember it. A mother-in-law makes a plan for her daughter-in-law to go to the feet of an older man in a dark, desolate corner of a threshing floor. And in the light of the Me Too movement and stories of older, more powerful men who have taken advantage of younger, more vulnerable women, there is a risk that we may reread this back into the text, that we may read many of our modern assumptions back into this ancient text. And so what I'm going to do as we go throughout it is I'm going to slow down in two places and bring it back into its ancient context so we can bring it back into our modern day. So let's look at Ruth 3. In the beginning, we're told that Naomi creates a plan. This plan is for Ruth, as I mentioned, to go and wait at the outside of the threshing floor while Boaz is eating and drinking. When he's finished, he lies down, he's feeling comfortable and happy to see where he's laying, because in the pitch black, you won't be able to find him. And when he falls asleep, to sneak down to the threshing floor, to lay down at his feet, and to uncover his feet. And there's two things that we need to appreciate about this situation in order so that we don't misread everything. Because it'd be so easy to misread our own story and our own lives into this. In fact, if you're single here today, or you remember being single many years ago, you may even misread Naomi's intentions. That you may see Naomi through the window of an over-meddling stepmother trying to hitch her daughter-in-law. Maybe you remember stories of your parents or family members saying, "So when are you going to settle down? Marry a nice boy and girl, maybe have some kids. You know, your father or your mother and I would really like to have grandkids, you know. Maybe some of you remember that time. And maybe you're thinking that if this plan doesn't go well for Ruth, that Naomi just may go and set up the ancient equivalent of an ancient dating profile for Ruth. Maybe something like this. Ruth 20, fun-loving Moabite, seeks new home in Bethlehem. Potential suitors must be family-oriented. That we may read our own stories into Naomi. But Naomi isn't an over-meddling stepmother, but one who cares deeply for her daughter-in-law and longs for her to know a new future and a new hope. And we may also think that this plan is simply a bad plan. Go and tell your stepdaughter to go to the feet in a dark, desolate corner of a threshing floor to an older, more powerful man where no one will see what happens. This seems to us like a crazy and reckless plan. And so right now, I want us to hear two things that we need to know to understand that Naomi's plan, while risky, is not reckless, and that it's in proportion to the situation that Ruth and Naomi are in, and especially Ruth's situation. The first thing we need to know is that they are banking on the goodness of Boaz. That Boaz isn't just some stranger that Naomi is sending her daughter-in-law Ruth to go and lay at the feet of, but this is a man who so far has shown himself to be trustworthy, who has acted with care and integrity towards Ruth. That so far, given his situation and the power that he had in the field, he would have had every opportunity to take advantage of Ruth had he wanted to. But instead, he deals with kindness and tenderness and mercy and generosity poured towards this vulnerable woman. That last week, Pastor Ken said that Boaz's name means strength. And it's not just physical strength as a farmer in the field, but that he shows moral strength. He shows integrity. And so Ruth and Naomi are banking on the goodness of Boaz because so far they have every reason to do so. That Boaz has shown integrity, moral strength of character, deep generosity, and care towards a woman who others would have discarded. The second thing we need to remember is how dark and desperate, especially Ruth's situation was. That we're told coming to Bethlehem that they are in a very vulnerable position personally and economically. That as women and as widows, they did not have the same opportunities that many of us have today. That even though many women today do not have equal opportunity to men, they had far less opportunity than many of us have. That she couldn't have refreshed her CV, her resume, and gone out and applied for jobs, but that she was at the mercy of others. Having no immediate family, having no social connection, having no provision or protection or disposable income, that they were banking on the mercy of others, that they were completely reliant on the mercy of others. And so Ruth goes and works in a field and is basically given just enough to live day by day, even though it's more than she expected, and Boaz acts in generosity, that the desperation of their situation is increasing. As the harvest season is coming to an end, which means that Ruth would no longer have had the opportunity to glean daily in Boaz's field. And she would also lose the opportunity that she had one-on-one with Boaz. We also need to remember that Ruth is a Moabite, and that Israelites would have seen Moabites through the window of shame. That Moabites, in the eyes of people from Bethlehem, had a shameful beginning. That as we're told in Genesis 19, that Lot, who was Abraham's nephew, when he was in his older age with two daughters and his wife had passed on, that his daughters had not been able to conceive and bear children. And so one evening they get their father drunk, sleep with him, and the eldest daughter bears a son named Moab, who became the father of the Moabites. And so in the eyes of anyone from Bethlehem, they would have looked at Ruth through the window of her cultural shame. that before she even arrived in Bethlehem, that she already had a number of strikes against her. That the people of Bethlehem would have seen her as someone who was in a hopeless situation and who was unredeemable. Growing up, I played soccer for many years, and our soccer team did these bottle drive fundraisers where we would drive throughout the city, knocking on doors, asking people if they had any bottles or cans that we could take for our fundraiser. And we would fundraise, knock on doors for a number of weekends, and then we would take them to a recycling depot and cash them in. And after they had finished counting the bottles, a manager or someone else would come out. They would give us the money, as well as a few other bottles. And these are ones that they said were unredeemable. That even though most of the bottles were redeemable for cash, that there were a few that he explained were completely unredeemable, that they couldn't take them back. That they were either too dirty, too unclean, or too broken to have any value. That he would explain that you might as well throw them away because they're as good as garbage. And this is the way that people in Bethlehem, that most people in Bethlehem, would have seen Ruth. Through the eyes of her past and her cultural shame, they would have seen her situation as hopeless and her as unredeemable. Her story and her life as too broken to have any value. And they would have completely discarded her and written her off. And this is the beauty of Naomi's plan. That she believes that there is the work of an invisible hand who is conspiring in the favor of her and of Ruth, who does not believe in hopeless situations or unredeemable people. And so Ruth, and therefore Naomi, create a plan and follow through with this plan with boldness and courage, even willing to take on some risk themselves, to believe that there is a God and an opportunity for them. That there are no hopeless situations and there are no unredeemable people. So after we're told about Naomi's plan, we're told that Ruth follows through with the plan. That she takes off her mourning clothes because she would have been mourning her dead husband. She puts on her best clothes. She takes a spray of perfume, you know, maybe a little spray of Bethlehem number 5. And she goes down to the threshing floor and she waits for Boaz to finish eating and drinking till he's feeling pretty good. And sees where he's laying. Then she goes to his feet, lays down and uncover his feet. And if you've ever woken up in the night with a shiver, perhaps you tossed and turned and your feet were exposed to the cold air or your back, then you'll know this is actually a really good plan. That Naomi and therefore Ruth don't want to wake up Boaz in the middle of the night, perhaps worry him that something's happening and get him to wake up everyone around them, but to get him to wake up slowly and subtly, to look down at his feet, which would have been cold. And as he looks down at his feet, he sees a woman lying there, to his surprise. And seeing a woman, he says this, "Who are you?" She replied, "I am your servant Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." Spread the corner of your garment over me. In a dark, secluded corner of the threshing floor, wouldn't it be so easy for us to imagine that this was an ancient proposal for a hookup? But again, this is where we may read our own stories and our own lives and our own language into an ancient story. Instead, this wasn't a proposal for a hookup, but a proposal for marriage. That in their culture, it would have been traditional for a bride to, or a husband, a groom, to cover his bride with the edge of his garment as a way of symbolically saying, "I want you to come under my provision and protection. I want you to come into my family and that we would be one. That I will uphold my side of the bargain and I will care for you." And for Ruth, who was a widow in a very desperate and dark economic situation with very little opportunity. We may imagine that that would have been enough for her to ask for. But Ruth is asking for more. And this more connects to something that Boaz had said to her back in chapter 2. That in the field, Boaz looks to Ruth and says to her in a prayerful way, "I've been told all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people that you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And what we miss in our English translation is that the word for wing and the word for garment are the same word. That would you come under the wing, the garment of Israel? That Boaz's initial prayer and conversation for Ruth is that he's essentially saying, the God of Israel, under whose protection, under whose land you have come, among his people, that this God does not believe in hopeless situations and unredeemable people. Even though everyone else sees you as hopeless and unredeemable, may you come under his protection, under his wing, and come into his family. And Ruth is saying, in effect, won't you, Boaz, be the answer to your own prayer? You prayed that I would come under the wing into the family of God, that he would cover the shame of my past, give me a new identity and a new future, unlock the door from the outside and give me a new hope. You can do that. By bringing me into your family, you will not only cover me with your protection and your provision, but you will cover the shame of my past, that you will give me a new future, a new hope, and a new identity. That her and Ruth, her and Naomi, are saying that in God's eyes, just as you, Boaz, have said, that there are no hopeless situations or unredeemable people, and therefore take me into your family. At this time, I'd like to welcome Nancy Lee, who is a member of our 10th Church community, to come up here and share a part of her own story with us and how it connects to this passage in Ruth. Thanks, Nancy.
I was in love. I'd met a man who was charming and charismatic. We were planning a future together. We talked of children, we've talked of marriage. And who doesn't love that feeling of being in love? Until we had our first disagreement. It was a small matter, but his reaction was disproportionate to what the event actually became. It resulted in a broken plant on the ground. It was just a foreshadowing of the things that were to come. In the months following, I would experience emotional, physical, financial abuse. I would have my purse thrown out of the window of a car. There would be all-night rants. My emails would be monitored. The passwords of my computer would be changed. I'd have clumps of my hair pulled out. I'd have bruises and lashes all over my body in places where clothing were covering. And I would lie to doctors about broken bones. I walked on eggshells every day. I felt very trapped, very hopeless in my situation. People often ask, why do victims stay with their abusers? I'd come to learn there was actually a chemical dependency, a biochemical dependency called trauma bonding that happens. And trauma bonding happens when victims live for the crumbs of affection and the crumbs of attention that you get during the periods of abuse. When I was not walking on eggshells, I was in denial. How could a man who said he loved me and cared for me hurt me in this way? I was also deeply shameful. And the hallmark of shame is actually feeling like you cannot share, that you want to hide what it is you actually feel. I told no one about my situation, not my friends, not my family, not my church community. One particular night when I was feeling extremely hopeless, I looked at the kitchen counter and I saw a knife block sitting there. And I wondered what it would feel like to put that knife through my chest. I didn't want to feel isolated anymore. I didn't want to feel hopeless anymore. That was my wake-up call. I couldn't believe that I'd let a man who I thought I loved have me sacrifice my personal, physical, emotional safety and welfare. That night, I knew that I needed to do something different, that I needed to risk. So while he was sleeping, I snuck out my cell phone and I texted a woman in my church community. At first, I just asked her to pray for me. I didn't disclose any details of what's actually happening, but I did ask her to not respond. And I also deleted the message after I sent the text because I knew if he found out, I would be beaten. As the cycle of abuse continued, I would be more descriptive about the abuse that was happening. The broken bones, the bruises all over my body, the hair pulling. And it was in that moment that the women of my church rallied around me. They did something that I could not do for myself. They came into my story. They called the police. The police showed up at my door. Eventually, he would be arrested. And after many years of a criminal trial, he would be convicted. The courage to trust and the courage to be vulnerable, to reach out for help, in what seemed like a very unredeemable and hopeless situation, that's what allows me to stand here today to be able to share with you and to have a second hope on life.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you. I was talking with Nancy before she came of whether she wanted me to read her story or she wanted to read it herself. And she said that she wanted to read it in person so that she could look at every one of you and say that if you are in a situation like she is, if you feel trapped in a dark and broken situation or in a very bad relationship, that you are not alone. That you are not alone. And today, like Ruth, like Naomi, and like Nancy, we invite you, if this is your life, if this is your situation, to take a step forward. That you may feel like the door to freedom, to your life, is locked from the outside. We want to tell you that you're not alone. So after the service, if you want to come forward and tell somebody here, Nancy and I will be up front and Sean will be in the back. Our prayer team will also be to my left. If you want to share with them, they can let us know what you're going through a little bit later. If your situation is particularly dark and desperate and immediate, then let me encourage you to reach out to a friend or to a family member, or if you're able, to reach out like Nancy's friends did to 911 or to the Crisis Support Network. And I've put their number here for you. It's 1-800-SUICIDE. Even if you feel like the only place that you can go in your own life and in your story is to take your life. This God does not believe in hopeless situations and unredeemable people. That whether you talk to one of us or you call 911 or the Crisis Center of BC, that they'll talk you through the next steps and tell you the resources that are available to you. But this church family, that this God, do not believe in hopeless situations and unredeemable people. And into the conflict of Ruth's life, Boaz says these words to her. "And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. And although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, then good. Let him redeem you. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here in the morning, until the morning." That even though redemption hasn't come, Boaz makes a promise. That redemption is on the horizon and that it's coming. That Ruth's situation is not hopeless and unredeemable. He makes a promise. And this is the Christmas story. That into our dark and desperate world, that Jesus, for whom redemption is still on the horizon, breaks into the world and is born in a lowly stable in Bethlehem, near where Ruth and Naomi met, perhaps in a stable filled with Bethlehem barley. And he makes a promise to us that the birth of Jesus is a promise that even though redemption may not be where you are in your story, that redemption is coming. That redemption is on the horizon. That God does not believe in hopeless situations or unredeemable people. And wherever you are today, whether you are where Nancy was a few years ago, or whether you feel trapped in some other kind of relationship or situation, that your situation is not hopeless, that you are not unredeemable. Would you pray with me? The end of Ruth 3. And Ruth has gone home and shared with Naomi what happened. Naomi speaks these words over her daughter-in-law. "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens. For the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. And over each of you, no matter how dark and desperate your situation and how trapped you feel like you are, Jesus speaks these words over you today. Wait, my daughter. Wait, my son, till you find out what happens. For the man, Jesus Christ, will not rest until the matter is settled." Amen.